With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us this morning on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, profit maximization versus cost minimization in tree nuts. We'll take a look at both. But our focus today, we are talking with California Congressman John Duarte. He represents the 13th District and lives in the Modesto area. He's also a fourth-generation farmer and serves on several House committees. He joined me by phone recently. I like to start off talking about a victory. So let's talk about the appropriations bill that was passed. We got some things funded. What was in there that you're excited about?
Well, a lot of my community projects. My district is very rural, a very small towns, and a lot of the city councils don't have big grant writers and that kind of help to get into some of the grant programs. And so we got some, you know, 9/11 call center projects, sewer line fixes, boring down to earth stuff, but things that can really tax a small town. For the city of Mendota, we got $5 million for general street improvements. For some of the small unincorporated areas, we've got other street and sidewalk improvements for them. They've never seen government resources come in, you know, in even the low millions. So these are big deals for small towns. And then we got a couple water infrastructure and recharge studies and basin enhancements. So that'll help some of the sustainability for water and some of the farmers in the district. It was exciting. It was the first year we'd done community project funding requests, and we did, I think, quite well in getting geared up to do them again this year.
Yeah, I was excited to read through the list. There are a few things for my home area. I'm from the Madera area, and there were quite a few things for infrastructure in there as well. And like you said, some of these things may come off as, you know, like the boring, run-of-the-mill kind of thing. But you're right. They are vital to some of these communities. Where else is the money going to come from? You know, when you need your storm drains replaced, or if you need something done with your pavement.
Yeah.
These are important projects.
Madera Mayor Santos Garcia sent me photos during the flooding last year where the sewer main blew out and cost the city millions of dollars. We got him $1 million for that project. We're happy to do it. What else? I think we got, storm drain, another $1 million for this Madera City storm drain pipeline replacement. So these are big amounts of monies for cities like Madera. They just lost their hospital. The community hospital went bankrupt there and had to close. And so it doesn't do everything they need, but it certainly takes some pressure off the city government.
Most of our listeners, we focus primarily on a lot of agricultural news, but we have so many that are also rural who also rely on knowing that some of these projects are going to be done. And, you know, often we hear that living out in the country, you feel a little left out. The cities get all the money. So it's nice to see something going to some of these more rural areas.
I'm on the Transportation Infrastructure Committee, and we just watched the grants come out from the big Transportation Infrastructure Jobs Act money, billions and, you know, over $1 trillion package altogether, and they're bleeding some of the money out. Our valley needs extra freeway lanes. The Highway 5 and Highway 99 are jammed up with traffic. People can't get to work. It really limits how some of these working families can look at the horizon of their job opportunities when freeways aren't flowing properly. And instead of getting money for the real infrastructure we need, the water infrastructure we need, all these things, the Biden administration put $3.1 billion towards the high-speed rail boondoggle. And it was just insulting. It was so insulting to my district, Tom McClintock's district, David Valadeo's district, to see all this federal resource that we're going to be paying taxes on go to a project nobody in the valley supports, when we could be building things that are very, very necessary to improve lives in the valley. So sometimes we not only don't get our stuff in our area funded, but we don't get the stuff that we value funded at the expense of other government idiocies.
Yeah, so let me ask you, how's that high-speed rail project going? We're seeing a lot of action on that? That's a loaded question that I know the answer to, but please.
Yeah, no, it's hard to watch. I mean, we've got these big elevated platforms in the sky that will never be connected. You know, Central Valley families need to get to work back and forth every day on roads that are complete, that meet their needs. We're paying gas taxes. We're paying income taxes. We're funding these things with government debt that we're going to have to pay off. And the high-speed rail just keeps, you know, you're driving down 99 stuck in traffic, hitting potholes. And it's like these platforms are above you there in Fresno, just laughing at you.
Yeah,
it's really, really unnerving. And a lot of the $3.1 billion will just be used for more environmental impact studies. I don't want to get lost on it today, but
sure.
Obviously if they'd have run the high-speed rail down the Highway 5 corridor like it was originally planned, it would probably be done by now. But when you try and cross these river canyons, freeways, railroads, cities, you end up flying above them with these elevated platforms of concrete and steel and just huge resources. It's going to be $130 billion to go from Merced to Bakersfield, and we still don't have the engineering as to how we get over the Tehachapi's or over to the coast. So it's a real horrible example of government ineffectiveness.
Yeah. The only thing that I have seen, this is petty, but I'm going to put it out there, that the only good thing I have seen from this is that, again, in my home county of Madera County, when you're on, I think it's Avenue 11, maybe it's 10 that it's on, and you go onto that over ramp that they made for the high speed rail, you can stop because there's never any traffic. And I mean, there's never any cars out there, but you can stop at the very top of that and get some very beautiful pictures of ag land. Of course, yeah, it's the ag land that they had to come in and destroy to put the, you know, the thing there, but still it's gorgeous.
No, that's a small benefit.
Yeah.
I'd buy a drone.
Yeah. Yeah. There's so much more we could say about the high-speed rail, but we won't because that's it's a lot. We're talking this morning with California Congressman John Duarte. We come back to the conversation later on in the show. In today's National Spotlight, farmers are sending critical aid to ranchers in Texas. Michael Clements reports.
Denali is a leading recycler of organics on a mission to replenish the earth by repurposing waste. Their work touches thousands of acres in dozens of states and builds soil fertility and helps farmers be more resilient. Sam Liebel from Denali shares more about their work and efforts to assist Texas ranchers affected by recent wildfires.
This has been the largest wildfire event in Texas history. The fires in the Panhandle have burned more than 1 million acres. They've killed thousands of livestock, and they've destroyed much of the hay and pasture that ranchers were relying on. Families have had their lives upended by this disaster, and the lack of feed makes rebuilding that much harder for them. So in response, we at Denali are working with our farming and trucking partners to deliver more than 700 round bales of hay to a Texas A&M livestock supply point in the Panhandle. From there, the hay will be distributed to ranchers in need. And this donation is more than 385 tons of hay, which is enough to feed hundreds of animals for several weeks.
The effort, Liebel says, is driven by farmers.
So this is a partnership between Denali, our transportation partner, J.B. Hunt, and several of the farmers that we work with in Missouri and in Arkansas. We felt driven to help the producers in Texas hurt by the fire. And every day we work with a large network of farmers across the country, and we reached out to some of them to make this donation happen. So in particular, these hay donations are coming from farmers Jerry Evans of Fairview, Missouri, Jamie Marion of Alma, Arkansas, and Hunt Farms of Dardanelle, Arkansas. So at Denali, we have purchased additional hay from these farmers to increase the size of the donation. And we're working with our trucking partner, J.B. Hunt, to take care of the transportation piece. This is really farmers helping farmers, and we at Denali are happy to be a part of it.
Denali supplies farmers with organic fertilizer that helps them boost their yields and allows them to have excess hay for donations like this one.
So at Denali, we work with farmers and with food production facilities to recycle nutrients as fertilizers on farmland. We take residuals from facilities that make things like ice cream, soup, beef, and chicken, and we match those residuals with the fertilizer needs of farmers. Farmers often see increased yields and lower input costs with our services, and the soil health is improved because there's a good deal of organic matter in this material. For the farmers donating feed, the boost in plant nutrients has increased their yields to the extent that they are able to give a significant amount of hay to Texas ranchers. And we hope that it helps those ranchers as they rebuild their lives and their livestock operations.
For more information about Denali and their efforts to support farmers and ranchers for a more resilient food system, please visit DenaliCorp.com. Donations to Texas ranchers impacted by the wildfires can be made to Texas A&M Service. Michael Clements reporting.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Will Jordan with the Livestock Report.
In today's livestock news, the Beef Checkoff, which is overseen by the producer-led Cattlemen's Beef Board, utilizes the federally mandated $1 per head of cattle sold to drive demand for beef through promotion, education, and research. At the heart of the checkoff program is transparency, ensuring that each dollar is invested wisely for producers and by producers. Cattlemen's Beef Board Senior Director of Evaluation and Outreach, Becca Wall, shares more.
So transparency is something we take very seriously at the Cattlemen's Beef Board. One of the things that if you're a producer, you're paying into the checkoff. You should know that all meetings are open for your attendance. So if you come to a meeting, please come. All the meetings are posted on our meeting center on the website. One of the things, too, that is kind of come out of the COVID era is Zoom meetings or virtual meetings. And so the Beef Promotion Operating Committee is the 20-body producer committee that makes the funding decisions for what your dollar is going to be funded for in promotion, research, consumer information, industry information, and foreign marketing. And so through COVID, we now have a virtual link where you as a producer can log in and watch that whole process take place. So I really encourage people and tell them about that, because that's not something that everybody got a front row seat to prior to COVID. The other transparency piece is all of our audited financials are available on the website. We do an annual report every year that's available to any producer on our website, as well as an evaluation report that talks about the progress of programs and our contractors, you know, fulfilling what they said they were going to do, which they do. But we put all of that information out there for producers who pay into the program.
Funding research, promotion, and education, the Beef Checkoff drives demand for beef, yet the contractors that fulfill this mission have hoops to jump through before seeing any checkoff dollars. Wall shared more on the cost recovery aspect of the checkoff program funding.
Not everybody might know is even though contractors are awarded funds, they don't get those funds up front. They have to front the cost of the programs that they're going to do, and then they turn in invoices, and that all gets reviewed by our office, USDA, to make sure that the funds that are being spent are according to the act and the order. So it's a cost recovery program in that sense, where you have to have the money up front to pay for what you want to do, and then you submit your reimbursements to the Cattlemen's Beef Board for the work that you've done. So I like to tell producers that may not know, because it kind of gives that assurance that it's not just free money up front. You have to have skin in the game up front and have to be able to fund those programs.
To learn more about the Beef Checkoff and the Cattlemen's Beef Board, visit beefboard.org. I'm Will Jordan for AgNet West.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
Considerations to maximize profits is especially important for nut growers facing economic challenges. Cooperative Extension Specialist Brittany Goodrich noted that doesn't necessarily mean cost minimization.
I think we saw this a lot with our almond crop last year, where prices were not great, so growers cut back on winter sanitation and other navel orangeworm management practices, and what happened was extreme damage rates. So it's important to make sure that you're thinking clearly about what are you actually spending and what is your return on investment from that spending. I always kind of joke and say that when we're in these times, we need to start thinking like a corn and soybean farmer in the Midwest. And I'm originally from Iowa, so that's why I like that analogy, but really being very intentional with how we're spending our money and what that return is on that investment.
A bipartisan coalition of 30 U.S. House members is urging the House Agriculture Committee to prioritize federal support for specialty crop mechanization research in the 2024 Farm Bill. The lawmakers emphasize the importance of innovative technology in supporting the competitiveness and longevity of the specialty crop industry, which faces challenges due to labor shortages. In a letter addressed to Committee Chairman Glenn Thompson and Ranking Member David Scott, the lawmakers stressed the need for investments in mechanization and automation research to address rising input costs and labor challenges. Last year, they introduced legislation to establish a $20 million a year research grant program for specialty crop mechanization. The Specialty Crop Farm Bill Alliance is also supporting this initiative, emphasizing the critical role of innovation in ensuring a strong agricultural workforce and a robust farm economy. The Natural Resources Conservation Service has a long history of assisting ranchers with livestock pond restoration. With restoration efforts coming under more regulatory oversight through the years, NRCS ecologist Jackie Charbonneau explained that ranchers needed a different kind of assistance, which has continued to evolve.
We started doing pond restoration, kind of being that in between with the regulatory agencies and the ranchers to help get the permitting done. And then it evolved into the technical assistance aspect of it too, with engineering and biology assistance. assistance. And really, the programs evolved over time, and the primary kind of request was from the ranchers, and then from an NRCS and RCD standpoint, it was important not only for livestock water, but the ponds were habitat for tons of wildlife. Our focus has primarily been on restoring habitat for California red-legged frog and the California tiger salamander, both two federally listed species.
The UCANR Nematology Workgroup will be hosting the 54th California Nematology Workshop next week in Parlier. The workshop will feature presentations of the newest management tools for plant parasitic nematodes in annual and perennial crops. The 2024 Nematology Workshop will take place at the Kearney Agricultural Research and Extension Center on Tuesday, March 26th, beginning at 8 in the morning. Along with information about new regulations, common tools for nematode management, and hands-on experience in the nematology lab, the event will also feature a field tour to highlight strategies for finding nematodes out in the field. Farm advisors, field research representatives, PCAs, growers, and consultants are all encouraged to attend. More information about the workshop is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
After several months of declines, retail egg prices are climbing again. That's coming up on This Land of Ours.
Back in January of 2023, average retail prices for eggs peaked at about $4.80 a dozen, partly the results of avian influenza, the bird flu, that resulted in the losses of millions of egg-laying chickens. After January 23, egg prices began a steady downward trend, and
prices for eggs are still down significantly from where they were at their peak early last year.
But USDA economist Megan Schweitzer says egg prices this year have started to climb again. They went up last month 8.5%. They're now averaging $2.92 a dozen compared to $2.28 a year ago.
Largely because new cases of avian influenza were detected at the end of last year in November and December.
The laying flock currently about 1% smaller than a year ago because of bird flu. However,
we haven't seen many cases in February and March so far this year. So if that trend continues, that could be good news for egg prices down the line.
This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
We continue our conversation from the beginning of the show with Congressman John Duarte, who represents California's 13th district. But let's talk about, if we can, if you let me talk a little bit about the Farm Bill. Would that be okay?
Sure.
As we're getting funding going and we're seeing some wheels turning, what are you thinking about the Farm Bill? Will we still see one this year?
You know, I'm up in the air on that. Any Farm Bill that we do this year will probably have to go through suspension, meaning we need 2/3 of the entire Congress to vote for it, which also to some degree means it may be a spending blowout, which there's not a lot of appetite for. There's a lot of money already in the Farm Bill. If we look at some of the Inflation Reduction Act or Inflation Inflammation Act, we call it. There's a lot of money in farm programs for conservation that is going to be spent over the next 2 or 3 years. The logical thing that we need to do, which is what G.T. Thompson, our chairman of the Ag Committee from Pennsylvania, is proposing, is taking that money and smoothing it out over the next 10 years so we don't just blow it away in 3 years of really highly increased spending and then not be able to staff it or keep it. You know, right now there's a current bill out there to hire 1,500 Farm Service Agency people just to spend the money that's got to be spent within the next 2 or 3 years under the Inflation Reduction Act. So if GT can get a sensible extension on that money, pull it out, use it for the conservation programs for the next 10 years, not blow it all out at once, and then have a good farm bill that funds the commodity programs and the nutrition programs in a rational, reasonable way, then we've got something. But that's not what we're getting from the other side. Unless we can make a deal on that, I think we may be extending the 2018 Farm Bill, which is a good Farm Bill for specialty crops. It's known to be a pretty solid Farm Bill for specialty crops. So for California, it's not bad. We've done some good things for it with the Appropriations Bill. I'm on a bill with Jimmy Panetta, bipartisan bill called the Gates Act, which would take the income limit off qualifications for some of the conservation programs. If you want to use equip money to modernize your operation smog-wise or emissions-wise, if you want to use an equip grant to do a large recharge basin, these are things we want people to do, want farmers to do, even if they make more than $900,000 a year. And so by the Gates Act would make conservation participation in conservation programs eligible for everybody, including bigger farms. It can really have an impact on recharge basins and conservation. So even if the Farm Bill doesn't go this year, we're still going to do some good things to improve it.
The income restrictions have been a talking point for some people because they really do keep some of the larger farms from being able to participate. And California does have some good size farms that could benefit from these conservation programs, hasn't it?
They do. And in California, we're already going to have a shakeout of farms in California. We see it now. And this is, I was talking to Rick Crawford and Austin Scott the other day, and just off the floor in the house about ag pressures in our different areas. Rick Crawford's from Arkansas, Austin Scott's from Georgia. The land values are different, the crops are different, but the situation's the same. There is nothing that farmers are growing right now that's profitable. And we are all eating our equity away. I'm a farmer myself, year by year, continuing to operate. And a number of best of breed farmers, families I've known for decades and generations, have come to me and said, we can go one more year and then we have to shut down. Selling property to recapitalize in a soft market as we have now with high interest rates, low exports. We've got to turn this ag economy around quickly, or we're not going to keep our family farmers in business. And a lot of them are above the income limits for some of the conservation programs. And the regulations oftentimes kind of predict that these families are going to participate in the EQIP grants. You know, you have to turn all your tractors in, but we're going to help you buy new ones. That works if you can participate in the EQIP program. It does not work if you get eliminated by the income limits. So I'm doing a bill also. If you look at the broad distress of agriculture today, it has to do, in my opinion, a lot with the retaliatory agricultural tariffs that were part of the trade battles we had a few years ago, and they stay there. And we won a lawsuit at the World Trade Organization over the retaliatory tariffs from China that went for 5 years. We won it last year, and the retaliatory tariffs from China are still in place. So the World Trade Organization is not providing solutions to some of these problems, and the impacts are being felt broadly across American agriculture. So I've got a bill called the Market Facilitation Retaliatory Agricultural Tariff Supplement Act, so MFRATS. What it would do is take $6 billion from the Commodity Credit Corporation and direct the secretary to refund that back to ag exporters to compensate them for the retaliatory ag tariffs against their products, if any. And so it would be very targeted. If you ship almonds to China and you have a 25% retaliatory ag tariff, we're going to assume that you had to drop your price 25% to compensate for that tariff, and the supplement program is going to put it back. What this will do is encourage American producers and marketers and shippers to clear the inventories, to ship those inventories into China, into India, into Turkey, where the big retaliatory ag tariffs are kind of holding back exports. We get those export markets back, and American agriculture is going to firm up because we'll get rid of those excess inventories and we'll get our pricing structure back to where the farmers are making money again and they can pay their bank loans, and we won't have a rural economic crisis as we're heading for now.
Please correct me if I'm wrong, because it's always possible, but it seems to me, from what I have seen in the last couple of years, this administration has not had strong focus at all on agricultural trade until maybe within the last few months. I saw a little bit more coming out about trying, like you mentioned India, about trying to do a little bit better with India. And a lot of that had to do with specialty crops. Do bills like this help bring a focus back into ag trade when we're not seeing it from the administration overall?
Yeah, the bill I'm proposing, my MFRATS bill, is something that the Secretary of Agriculture would have the authority to do under the Commodity Credit Corporation right now. We did under the Trump administration, except it was the market facilitation payments were made to all growers. Well, that didn't incentivize any growers to export to the retaliatory ag tariff market. So it was good to have the support, but it allowed the inventories to build up higher. Giving everybody money and not keeping those exports around didn't help clear the inventories. So this is something the secretary could do now. Secretary Vilsack could just start working on a program like this right now with his current authorities. They're not. We're not seeing any aspect of this administration perform competently across the board. In fact, you can't even make a deal with them. We make a deal for NEPA reform under the Fiscal Responsibility Act. That's being stepped away from. The Supreme Court comes down with the Sackett ruling to protect farmland and other landowners from onerous wetlands regulation. We'll see. It looks like the Army Corps of Engineers and EPA are going to claim a great deal of the jurisdiction that they were told they don't have by the Supreme Court, and I think it was an 8 or 9-0, 8-1 ruling. It was ridiculous. As part of the Fiscal Responsibility Act, the debt ceiling negotiations, bipartisan deal, we agreed that the tribes on the North Slope of Alaska could do some oil leases. That's being reneged on. So this is not only an incompetent, sleepy administration. This is an administration you can't make a deal with. It's that bad. And we've seen, you know, what's happening at the border. You know, they say they want to secure the border. We know they don't, because they've done everything they can to open the border. You know, we can talk about economic growth and jobs in America, but if we don't drill American energy, if we don't drill gas and drill oil and expand that as best we can, we not only hurt our own jobs here in America, we export our industries to China and to India, where they're building coal plants and have cheap electricity and have that kind of abundant strategy. Meanwhile, we can't balance our books and help our friends around the world geopolitically. So this administration is a broad disaster, and we're trying to find ways to work where we can to improve things until we can get past this.
We will be back with Representative John Duarte right after this. This is the AgNet NewsHour, and we'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. We continue today's featured interview with Congressman John Duarte. You mentioned immigration, and is it okay if we talk about immigration and sure. labor for a minute? Because there have been some requests for a long while to fix the H-2A program and to help with farm labor needs, which are crucial to California's agriculture, with so much of it being labor intensive. Have you seen any positive movement on that front?
Well, there's negotiations going on. I mean, the H-2A program, the wage schedules that were put out by the Biden administration for the H-2A program must have been designed to crush the H-2A program. I mean, companies participate in the H-2A program because they need accessible, competent labor to run their businesses. Well, you can't just give everybody $20 or $25 an hour through the H-2A program on top of the housing allowances, the traveling, and everything else that's the responsibility of the employer, and have that be economic. By not making the H-2A program workable, we're literally forcing the exporting of our hand labor crops to Mexico. And that's simply what's happening. If you look at the million tons of fresh produce coming in from Mexico, it's gone from 4 million tons in 2000 to about 20 million tons today. And it's growing. It's growing at a very steady clip. We have rumors a lot of it's being financed by cartels. They're making a fortune off the open border. They're selling access to America for thousands of dollars. We're enriching the cartels by billions of dollars a quarter. And they're investing it and competing with our farmers here in America. And we're making really dumb policy moves to make it even harder for our American farmers to compete with that coming out of Mexico. So again, it's very difficult to find a place where this administration under President Joe Biden isn't making matters worse for American businesses, American farmers, American working families.
Just this morning, I read something on the adverse effect wage rate. It was just clear to me from reading this article that people didn't understand the rule with how farm workers are paid and how that is calculated, I guess. And you mentioned, in fact, everything on top of their hourly rate, including transportation, the housing allowance, so many things that other workers don't get. You know, if you are working at your corner McDonald's or whatever, you're not getting also a housing money or transportation. So there has been also a, you know, call for fixing that wage rate. And there has been, you know, more conversations on that. Are you feeling like people are understanding that need? And when you talk to others in D.C., you know, as you're having these conversations, are they understanding the difference between what the farm laborers are actually getting versus what, you know, the minimum wage workers are getting?
I don't know. There is a bipartisan working group on that issue, and they've put out some reports that they're meeting with the administration. But I don't hear anything that hopeful that the administration is going to be changing policies and pulling those wage rates down again. I mean, and we've got, you know, and then look at the border. We've got folks coming across the border from all over the world, some of them getting flown in by the Biden administration on our nickel, paying off the cartels to get across the border, making a phony asylum claim as they come across the border, and then getting a work permit as they're paroled into the country. Then they go into the Central Valley, my district, and they can get a job. They've got a social security number. They've got a work permit. Families who've been living here in the shadows trying to go through the immigration process for decades are being stepped in front of by people who've bribed the cartels and made a false asylum claim. And this is a huge inequity up and down the valley. And there's no sign the administration wants to fix any of this. I hate to be that negative on the administration, but they're simply doing a lot of things that are coming down on the backs and the heads of working families that are trying to make ends meet. We've got food assistance in the Farm Bill at the highest it's ever been. We've elevated it even since the COVID levels. So government dependency is thriving, but we still have Kellogg's running Super Bowl ads telling financially stretched Americans to have breakfast cereal for dinner. This is the first generation of Americans that are reverting to a starch diet, taking produce and protein off their plates. And part of the reason we have huge ag inventories is retaliatory ag tariffs. The other part is these anti-energy, anti-growth, anti-farming policies on the part of this administration have simply crushed the consumer. And the consumer can buy a bag of potatoes and not much else. You know, when you look at housing costs, when you look at PG&E's electrical cost increase in the Central Valley, you know, families are stretched. And we saw consumer debt go up in 2023 to record high levels. The credit cards are maxed out. The job opportunities aren't emerging. And inflation continues to mount. We're really looking at perhaps the first generation of American working families whose diets are actually being depreciated versus enhanced. Produce and the proteins leaving the dinner plate, and families are thinking more rice, more beans, it's all we can afford. This is a train wreck and it's a disgrace, especially in a country that has the opportunity to produce so much of its own food, its own energy. I'm using terms like lords of scarcity versus champions of abundance. I'm promoting that we need to have a discussion about resource abandonment. It's kind of a moral and political issue. When you don't drill your own oil and you enrich Iran, you enrich Russia by not drilling your own oil while we're depleting our strategic petroleum reserve, this is a disaster. And so farmers are feeling it and working families are feeling it. Our consumers that would normally want to buy a lot of our premium foodstuffs are broke because this government policies have broken them. And you can't make that up with a snap benefit. I respect that we need to keep the nutrition programs in place, but we cannot replace opportunity with dependency. It won't work.
Yeah, and you said, you know, when we bring this back around to the farmers and especially to our California produce, that is the type of thing that people tend to not purchase when they are, you know, not making enough money and when inflation is too high. And then unfortunately, because they don't know, they blame the farmers and say, oh, the farmers are making so much money off of this. Yeah. When we all know, you know, we know that it's not the farmers making money off of that at all. They're struggling as much as everybody else in many cases. But Congressman, we started this on a happy note. Tell me you've got something to finish on a happy note with. What are you hopeful about right now?
Well, I'm hopeful that we're going to quit abandoning our resources. We're going to start in the next couple of years, get our policies right. We have the water. We have the energy here domestically. We have the people. We can do better. We've done better and we can do better. And I think the American voters are waking up and understanding that feel-good ideas that are untested may or may not work. And we shouldn't test them on a nationwide scale and make a full religious type commitment to them before we've seen them successfully improve lives. And I really think that's where we're heading. I think that's where these elections are going to take us. And I do believe a year from now, we'll be talking about America moving forward with policies that work for working families and work for farms and business, pro all forms of energy, pro American energy, water on the farms, being rational about our industrial policy, and really having a large consensus around the benefits of abundance versus the cost of scarcity. And we're going to change directions. The nice thing is, 4 years ago, before COVID, 5 years, Americans knew what it was like to thrive, you know, broadly. Then we had COVID. We handled that probably with a little bigger hammer than we needed. And then coming out of COVID, we chose scarcity policies. We chose to not drill, optimize our domestic energy. We chose not to free our business. We chose not to let the market take care of wages and such things. And we chose not to invest in infrastructure that we actually need versus infrastructure that might feel good or satisfy some constituency that isn't most of us. We can fix these things. These things we can do better at. And I think we will very soon.
All right. Do you have anything else that you wanted to talk about or anything else you'd like for my listeners to know?
No, I really appreciate the time here, Sabrina. We covered a lot of ground. I'm honored to represent my district. These are working families. This is a Hispanic Voting Rights Act district here in California. Mm-hmm. It's a fairly Democratic district historically. I'm really happy to be able to come here and fight to make the changes that help working families in my district and find policies that help working families across America.
Thank you again to Representative John Duarte, who represents California's 13th district and is a fourth-generation farmer. If you'd like to hear that full interview again, you can listen to our podcast. You can find it anywhere you listen to podcasts. Just search for the AgNet NewsHour. We'll be right back. Although preparing for retirement may seem daunting, especially for farmers, avoidance is not the answer. Michael Clements shares more.
Paying off debt and getting your savings on track is a challenge with day-to-day expenses on the rise. And AARP Oklahoma State Director Sean Voskel says planning for retirement often comes as a surprise.
For most people in their late 40s to late 50s, there comes a moment when they realize they're financially unprepared for retirement. They haven't saved much to begin with and are already halfway through their working life. Of course, there are no magic solutions or quick fixes, but there are practical steps to take.
Voskel says it all starts with making a financial blueprint.
That will help you know where you stand and what options make the most sense for your individual circumstances. Just as farmers create a budget for their operation, it's a good idea to create a budget for your retirement. Planning really helps you make intelligent choices about your finances. And think about your estate plan for your farm operation, too.
And Voskel says, be sure to know all your retirement options.
Automate your savings as much as possible and get out of debt, especially credit card debt. But perhaps most importantly, invest the time into understanding the benefits and choices you'll face with Social Security and Medicare. These hard-earned benefits are critical for financial security. Once all those factors are considered, plan for how you want to spend your retirement. Perhaps moving somewhere warmer or traveling often may be goals you should start planning for now.
Learn more Thursday night at 9 p.m. Central Time on RFD TV or online at aarp.org/AARP Live. Michael Clements reporting.
Import of organic food products is a growing aspect of our nation's consumer demand for such goods. Rod Bain has more.
Consumer demand in our country for organic food products has led to more domestic production and imports. USDA research economist Sharon Skorbianski at this year's Ag Outlook Forum said among the types of organic foods that are being imported to our country,
the value fell for the highest value commodities, blueberries, avocados, soybean, and coffee. But the value did increase for some other commodities like olive oil and bananas.
In fact, imports of organic goods have increased annually since 2015. Particularly in the area of tracked imports.
The value of tracked imports has been trending upward, and it increased in 2023 as well. But 60% of the value of these imports can be attributed to new harmonized tariff schedule codes, or HTS codes.
As the U.S. uses HTC codes to set tariff rates and statistical categories for imports such as organic products like dates and maple syrup. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet NewsHour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.